Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. Today we begin a series on the management of ovarian cancer, and we're thrilled to have Dr. Katie Moore joining us today from the Stevenson Cancer Center at the University of Oklahoma in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all our webinars, we have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. You'll get a lot more out of this if you take it. We'll learn a little bit about you. We're doing webinars all the time now. Next week, we'll be starting another series on AML and MDS with Dr. Dauver. Then we'll be doing a program on metastatic colorectal cancer, talking about what's new in that disease as well. Then on Thursday, the 21st, we'll be doing a program in looking at immunotherapy and the management of localized non-small cell lung cancer, adjuvant, neoadjuvant therapy. Then on the 26th, I'm really looking forward to this mantle cell webinar. We're going to run by the idea of first-line BTK inhibitors and some regimens that maybe you haven't heard about, and then get into how that's going to affect a progressive disease. We're going to start another series on September 28th on gastroesophageal cancers, and then we're doing a program on October 3rd on non-melanoma skin cancer. A lot of interesting developments, particularly related to immunotherapy. If you're into audio programs, check out our podcast series, including a recent Oncology Today program with Dr. O'Malley on some of the gynecology and ovarian cancer presentations from the ASCO meeting. But today we're here to speak with Dr. Moore about what's going on with ovarian cancer, where things might be heading in the future. And as we always do in this series, we have a bunch of docs in community-based practice, both medical oncologists and gynecologic oncologists, will be presenting cases today. Here's where we're heading today. We're going to start out. I had a few questions for Katie and also a case that was sent in to me. Then we'll go through the case presentations on video. We'll show you the investigator survey, and then a journal club. We'll go through some of Dr. Moore's paper. And as we do all with all our programs, we have a whole bunch of slides in the appendix that we're not going to go through, but for you to check out. So, Katie, just before we start going into the cases and data, et cetera, a couple of things I wanted to ask you. First, I'm just kind of curious, you know, this the SOLO-1 trial, which you were the principal investigator of, was really the first study that really showed the potential benefits for PARP inhibitors. That study was focused on BRCA patients, and of course, subsequently, we've gotten a lot of data on other PARP inhibitors in non-BRCA situations. But I'm just kind of curious, that's such a landmark trial. If you could just kind of briefly relate a little bit about, you know, when you first started thinking about this, you know, what was motivating you to focus on just the BRCA patients, what you thought you were going to see, and what you felt or thought when you saw the data for the first time.
Well, we're going to have a little bit of a history lesson because we're going back over a decade. The first thing I just want to say in response to that question is that this SOLO-1 was developed as part of a team, and I was a junior member of that team. So for all of my junior faculty out of there, just volunteer to be a part and to help, because that's how I got on the team. I asked then Paul DiSilvestro, who is the co-PI of SOLO-1, and Mike Bookman to help, and they appointed me the PI, and that was how I became the PI. It's teamwork. So this was a team, not just me. And you know, we came into this, was discussed in 2012, 11 and 12, we were discussing this and it was very controversial. There was a lot of thought that we were over-treating, that all of the large population proportion of these patients with BRCA associated cancers were cured with surgery and chemo alone. We're going to over-treat them. And then that was one hand. Other hand was like, oh no, we need to use the PARP. We need to use the PARP forever. Can't limit the PARP. Who is going to come into the study? You know, the eligibility criteria. It was very new to have this biomarker restricted study, the first of its kind. And it really was teamwork bringing it forward in an international collaboration. I have many colleagues who are responsible for the success of SOLO-1, Nicoletta Colombo, many. So this was transformational, though. This is the first readout that I had the great honor to present at ESMO in 2018 with a 70% reduction in the hazard of progression with use of PARP. And the important thing about this slide are two things. There's many things, but two. One, look at the placebo arm. This was surprising. This was surprising because there was this bias that these patients were cured and they were just did great and they didn't need this PARP. And I'll remind the listener that the patients who ended up coming on SOLO were probably the best prognostic group clinically that we'll ever put on a study again. They were large. They're all BRCA, number one, largely stage three, largely primary cytoreduction to no gross residual. Great clinical parameters. If anyone's cured with chemo alone, it's this group. But look at that control arm. 20% recurred within 6 months of completing platinum. They are just as high risk as BRCA wild type, honestly. And so it's sort of, I say this all the time, there's no such thing as low risk advanced ovarian cancer. It doesn't exist. And so that was the biggest learning. I was very surprised by really how poorly the control arm did. And it made me recognize how high risk they were. The other thing to notice is the treatment arm, we eliminate that platinum resistant curve. It doesn't exist. And that's important because for this particular population where it was largely coming on to PARP with negative CTs and normal CA125s, we may have wiped out, and many of these women, these patients, whatever clones were left before they became heterogeneous and cured them. And we do see that on the long-term data. We can't talk about OS final analysis yet because patients are doing so well. But certainly at 7 years, we have 20% of patients on control. I think you have that slide. 20%. What, can you do one more? Do you have my PFS slide?
No, I think we just did survival.
That's okay. So we'll talk about survival first. So this is the overall survival with or without disease, which is important, 48 versus 67%. So order of magnitude better. And that's important. More important to me now I want to cure people. I'm getting greedy. So if you look at the same time point at 84 months, the patients who have not recurred, they've been off their PARP for 5 years and they have not recurred, 20% in the placebo arm. So that is your group who doesn't need PARP. Who are they? We need to figure that out and leave them alone. But 47% in the 45% in the olaparib arm have not recurred. So we converted about 25% more into this potential cure fraction. And those women are likely cured. And that's, we've never talked about that. And so I think that's just one of the key takeaways from SOLO. And now we need to replicate that for everyone else who doesn't have a BRCA mutation.
So I can imagine you as a junior investigator starting to think about this and maybe never realizing what you were going to see, you know, a number of years later. What an incredible moment I think that really was. But also leading to the second thing I want to ask you about before we get started, which is, as always happens when we do webinars, I get emails from people who ask about cases. And so, and actually, this sort of relates to the other end of this issue, which are the people who are not BRCA. And particularly those who are LOH negative, HR proficient. So the email that I received was actually from a physician, but who's not an oncologist who watches our webinars and actually knew we were doing this webinar. She's not able to attend because she's traveling, but wanted me to ask you, and I'm going to send her what you have to say. I mean, not exactly looking for a second opinion, but just your general input, really. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, I think 7 or 8 months ago, had debulking surgery, chemotherapy. And interestingly, she managed to get on a study of the Neovax vaccine, which has been used. And we talked about this in our melanoma program a few weeks ago. These are personalized vaccines to neoantigens that are personalized to the patient's tumor. So she went on that study, and that's combining it with nivolumab. The tumor's a BRCA wild type and HR proficient. The trial allows her to take niraparib, And she's just curious what your thoughts are about, you know, this is a question we've been talking about for a long time. How do you manage these patients? Does PARP have a role in these patients? I just put up this study, you know, the data here, just to remind us that the PRIMA study with niraparib in the HR proficient patients you see over on the right has a rate of 0.65. Of course, not as good as with BRCA, just, you know, as in the SOLO trial, really good, a better hazard rate there. But then the rucaparib study also, HR proficient, hazard rate 0.65 by coincidence. So two trials showing benefit. You can decide whether it's, you know, useful or not. She heard you say something I never heard you say. I don't know if it was on our program and I didn't pick it up or something you wrote about it or whatever. I've never heard anybody say that they consider how people respond to platinum when they make this decision. So can you just, not so much about her case, although I don't know whether the prior immunotherapy has any, you know, relevance here, but just in general, how you make a decision about these BRCA proficient patients, particularly as it relates to PARP inhibitors. And if you do look at response to platinum, like how do you, like, you know, interpret it?
I have said that. So that does sound like me. And I've actually even gotten more extreme about it. So
that's what she said. Exquisite. She used the word exquisite in the email.
Exquisite chemosensitivity.
Exquisite sensitivity. Yeah.
So I'm becoming, I feel like I have sort of different like rabbit holes I go down. And I'm right now in a biomarker rabbit hole. Like I'm really thinking about biomarkers. And we could talk for an hour, but we won't. But the HRD, the LOH biomarkers that we use are good tests. I'm not saying they're not good tests, but they are not perfect. And they're nowhere near as functional as we need them to be. And there may be better things. So when you talk about use of PARP in the frontline in a tumor that's been declared homologous recombination, repair deficient, test negative, you say, I honestly don't care what the test says. I care how the tumor tells you how it's doing, at least when you're using neoadjuvant or you have disease you can assess. But I'm going to build on that in a moment. So when you have disease you can assess, you know those patients who are doing well. They're melting. There are tumors melting away. You get their CT, you get a CT before surgery, or you go to surgery and it's like this amazing response. That patient's getting a PARP. I don't really care what the assay says. Her tumor has told me it is incredibly sensitive to platinum, and for whatever mechanism exists for it, and they're so varied, it has homologous recombination repair deficiency or some deficiency in DNA repair mechanisms that makes it incredibly sensitive to platinum. And so that's someone I'm going to, even if their assay says it's going to be less effective, I'm going to take a risk there. I'll even add to that now, because I've gone down the KLM rabbit hole. I'm a believer in that analysis. And I actually really want to run a trial. It would just be huge to do. But that analysis for our readers, for listeners, you can get the algorithm for free on the internet. You just Google KELIM calculator. And all you need is in the first 100 days that your patient is treating, 3 CA125s, not pre-chemo though, post-chemo, 3 within 100 days. And you put it in there with the dates and it gives you a value greater than less than 1. So an unfavorable score that was looked at in the VELIA study of veliparib, so chemo veliparib, veliparib maintenance versus chemo no veliparib. A favorable score was more predictive of response to PARP than HRD status or BRCA, because there were patients with BRCA, and we know this now, to talk about biomarkers, the location and the type of BRCA mutation matters in terms of how sensitive you are to PARP. So there's some tumors that are BRCA that don't respond very well, and they have an unfavorable KLM score. Now, I'm still going to give them a PARP until I have something else, believe me. But if you have a favorable KLM score, I'm putting you on a PARP. 100%. I don't care what the assay says. The assay is not perfect. It's just a piece of the puzzle. If you have not responded, and your tumor, patients don't respond. Tumor hasn't responded, KLM unfavorable, HRD test negative. That's someone I'm going to be adding bevacizumab to if I haven't already added bevacizumab, or I'm looking for a clinical trial, or I'm doing molecular profiling and looking at tumor-associated antigens and really trying to get my patient set up for something more effective than what I have her on, because the likelihood is it's not going to hold her for very long.
Speaking of adding bevacizumab, this is one of the questions we asked in the poll. Most people, I think, said yes. I said no, actually. Would you add Bev to niraparib in an HR proficient situation if you could?
I like the combination. I really like the Paola data, especially for what you just said, BRCA wild type HRP. You know, in that patient that's responding really well. I like the combination, so I might try, but it wouldn't be my standard to do, and I might be more likely to do it with olaparib, but you can't use that. That's off label. So I wouldn't not ever use it, but it's not something I would commonly do.
So in our continuing series of things that Neil never heard of, but everybody else in the audience did, I actually, Gonzalo in the chat room about 5 minutes ago asked about KLM. And I'm like, what is KLM? And I just looked it up. So really cool idea. I just never heard of it before. Really interesting about this model they have. It sounds pretty cool. All right, let's get into some cases. This is going to come up again in some of the cases as well as it always does. But we're going to start out actually with a patient who's a BRCA germline, a patient, 54-year-old woman who's a patient of Dr. Morgenstein. Here's the case.
She's a lady I met many years ago. Interesting woman. So she knew she had BRCA. Her mother died of ovarian cancer, and she was diagnosed with a BRCA gene mutation many, many years ago, but really didn't proceed with any recommendations from her physicians, meaning no recommendations regarding breast surgery, and she had her ovaries in. Unfortunately, she developed ovarian cancer approximately 2 years ago. She had extensive disease. Back then, she was treated with combination of IV and IP chemotherapy and surgery, and she was placed on olaparib for 2 years, which she tolerated reasonably well. Approximately 2 years after that, she developed recurrent disease. She is back on chemotherapy consisting of carboplatin and paclitaxel with a plan to go back for second look surgery and then be placed back on a PARP inhibitor again. So in this patient, one is, and this is always a curiosity of mine, is there any more role for IP chemotherapy? It seems like it's really faded out of favor almost completely. And then the third question is, in the second relapse, should I continue PARP inhibition indefinitely? She tolerated it with no problem. Continue the same PARP inhibitor or switch PARP inhibitors?
So, yeah, a bunch of questions there. First of all, any thoughts about the case in general and the idea of repeating the PARP inhibitor? And how does that jive with the recent removal of PARP from many of the recurrent settings?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts. This is a great case, although I'm sad she has recurred. So I'm going to try and break it down. So number one, I'm sad that she recurred, but just on my biomarker theme and places where we have got to get better. And I was just at a conference virtually in Scotland yesterday with incredibly smart scientists who understand not just molecular profile and genetic profile, but the phenotype. BRCA1, I'd be interested to know what kind of BRCA1 she has. Because again, coming back to the location and type, you know, we know BRCA, well, we have suggestions from Paola, and we're trying to do this in solo, that mutations that are in the ring domain, perhaps they do better than nothing to PARP, but they don't do as well. And there's reasons for that. Whereas in the DNA binding domain, they actually do very well. These are the things we need to start paying attention to in these patients so that we can actually use rational combinations in patients who are likely to recur. Because maybe we could, in the future, prevent this patient from recurring. Because she had exceptional treatment at the beginning. Good surgery, IP chemo, PARP. You could not have done any better for her. So where did we fail? There's something that we could have done different. And that bothers me. And we need to work on that. So that's something we're thinking about. Two, at the time of recurrence, we were just discussing this at this conference yesterday, the distribution of recurrences, we need to track better. This idea of secondary surgery is still very controversial. There's one site that says we don't do it. There's one site that says we do. Some of our patients with BRCA who do recur post-PARP, there's a sense there's more oligomets. And whether or not we should be resecting those before chemo. And at ASCO, to Dr. Morgenstein's point, there was an interesting study called the CHIPPER study out of, I think, France, randomized phase 3, where they took patients with recurrence, gave them chemo, saw it respond, took them to the OR just as he's going to do, resected them, and then randomized them to additional chemo or maintenance, and they could get PARP, or they got HIPEC. And I was like, that's crazy town. I was listening. I'm like, ooh, crazy town. And then it has an OS advantage in the analysis. Okay, well, maybe I need to rethink that. There are a lot of us that were like, IP is dead and we're not doing IP and that's my bias. Okay, now you have my attention a little bit. I'm not saying we should do this, but I think that there's some thought to rethinking this. Now, post-IP, the abdomen may be quite difficult to get into. So I think that's another issue. And then the third is repeat PARP. Again, who knows? One, I would make sure we test for reversion mutation, because BRCA1, depending again on the type of mutation, this could have a reversion. If she has a reversion, I would not use a PARP 100%, and I would be going to Bev. If she doesn't have a reversion mutation and she's 2 years off PARP, who the heck knows if she's still PARP sensitive? Or, I mean, it may work just as well again. Or she may need a combination on a trial, which we don't have right now. So this is it. These are all the unknowns right now that make our panelists' job really difficult, because you're kind of guessing what to do. But I really think he's being super aggressive, and good for him.
So a couple of questions. First of all, can you test for reversion mutations in the community?
Yep.
Can you?
Yep.
Yeah, you can. That's cool.
And then you can send us.
I kind of have heard over the last couple of years in little whiffs of maybe IP therapies does better with BRCA patients. This study that you were just talking about where the IP did better, was that BRCA?
No, it was all comers. And I don't recall how many were BRCA. I'd have to pull up the slides. There was a small study done out of one of the original IP trials that looked at BRCA protein, not BRCA, the germline mutation. So it is flawed. But a hypothesis generating was the patients that had loss of BRCA protein, so presumably a BRCA mutation, did remarkably better with IP. So that's always been sort of the, as you said, a whiff of an idea. And there's some mechanistic rationale to why that would be true, but it's never been proven. But we do that here. So we don't want to leave anything on the table for a patient who's otherwise eligible.
Actually, Gonzalo in the chat room says BRCA was determined by IHC in the IP trials. Is that true?
Yeah, that's what I was just saying. It was determined by protein expression.
Well,
not by germline. And so they just went by low. If they had low protein, they presumed that patient had BRCA. So it was a surrogate. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Another question I had, you know, here, not infrequently, I hear cases like this where women know they're BRCA positive and yet don't do anything from a preventive point of view. I'm curious, you know, how often you see that. And also another issue for people who don't want surgery and, you know, maybe thinking about chemo prevention. I was talking with one of the docs about the fact that, you know, tamoxifen, the way it was determined that it helped in breast cancer prevention was that the adjuvant trials showed fewer second primaries. And I was wondering whether the trials of PARP maintenance, so show fewer second breast cancers. Not fewer breast cancers.
What a good question. We do track secondary malignancies in all of these studies and have presented that data, but I have honestly never sort of corrected it to population risk to see if we're seeing less or not. We do see them, a variety of BRCA and BRCA unrelated cancers, and we track them and update them, you know, with long-term follow-up. So we definitely see them, but do we see fewer than you would see otherwise in a patient, a non-affected by ovarian cancer patient population with BRCA? I actually do not know the answer to that.
Well, I'm talking about the people in the trial who didn't get PARP. You know, if you compare their risk of
breast
cancer.
Yeah, no difference.
Oh, there's no difference. Oh, interesting.
No, they look very similar.
Interesting.
Small numbers, but statistically very similar. Yeah.
All right, let's go to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Schneider, a gynecologic oncologist. Dr. Morgenstein is a medical oncologist. She also has a patient with a germline BRCA. This is a germline BRCA2. a 57-year-old lady, but the interesting thing about her is her stage. Here's the case.
Very healthy 57-year-old that presented with an adnexal mass, and you can see the imaging there. Her CA125 was very mildly elevated at 66. On questioning, she did have a significant family history. So she was taken to surgery. There was nothing else on the CT scan. The only abnormalities that we saw were in the pelvis. I did a diagnostic laparoscopy. We did a TAH, BSO, and staging. All of the disease was resected and it was all confined to the pelvis. And her pathology did return as a high-grade serous ovarian cancer stage 2. She completed Taxol and carboplatin. She was BRCA2 positive. So my questions for the group is it standard to recommend a PARP for stage 2? I did for her. She has completed her PARP. We did that for 2 years. And then my other question is, she adamantly wants a double mastectomy. And my question for the breast oncologists and surgeons in the group is, what are their recommendations with this earlier stage patient with a lot of anxiety?
I'll throw in stage 1 just for the heck of it.
Yeah. So all these questions without answers. So number one, I would have totally treated her as, I would have offered her treatment as well. So I 100% agree with that. Stage 2, you know, we consider stage 2 advanced disease. We used to call stage 1-2 early stage and everything else later stage, but the cure rate for stage 2, a fully staged stage 2, is only about 40%. So 60% risk they're going to come back. All comers, it's you treat them the same as an advanced stage. So even though those patients were not included in any of the studies, personally, I would absolutely offer her treatment. And I would absolutely stop at 2 years. And we'll see studies that are being proposed now, and I can't talk about them too much. We're actually thinking about de-escalating some patients to 1 year. So, but I would use, her risk of recurrence is high as a stage 2. As a stage 2 with BRCA, there's data. It is a single institution retrospective data, but it does come from a high-risk center at the University of Washington, where Dr. Norquist and Swisher practice. And they do so much high-risk, risk-reducing surgery, early-stage cancers, and follow them. And there is a higher risk of recurrence in this small study. It needs to be validated, but this is what we have. There is a higher risk of recurrence in stage 1 BRCA-associated ovarian cancer than compared to a BRCA wild type. And so even in a stage 1, I do think that there is a discussion to be had with that patient about use of PARP maintenance, with the caveat that we do see 1-2% AML-MDS. And it's an early event in these patients. We've seen it in all the studies in frontline. It's low, but it's there. And it's not related to the length you're using it. There's some CHIP mutation or something that sets our patients up to be at risk. And that can be a fatal event. I think we're so much better at treating it now, thanks to our brilliant hematologic medical oncologists. But still, it often is a fatal event eventually. So 1-2% is not that much unless you get it. So there is a risk. And you have to weigh the risk of recurrence versus that. But I have that discussion with patients, and I have not had difficulty getting it approved, although it is off-label. I will say that out loud. It is off-label and has not been studied, and it will likely never be studied because it's just not feasible.
What about her questions about the breasts in these patients? In what situations are you okay with mastectomy? Do you ever use, or these patients ever get tamoxifen or anything else for breast cancer prevention?
Oh, I think, you know, patients that have any sort of high penetrance mutation, whether it be BRCA1 or 2 or PALB2 or RAD51, BRIP, I send all of those patients to genetic counseling and to our high-risk breast colleagues. And they get really, I hope people have access to this, because that's what women, well, patients deserve. And they make a decision based on sound, evidence-based guidelines on what their risk of breast cancer is at what age. And they can decide based on that, just like risk-reducing surgery in someone the patient that was from before that knew she was BRCA, and everyone's always so anxious to get their tubes and ovaries out at, you know, 35 or 40. if you really sit down and really do kind of year by year analysis with someone who's skilled, sometimes you don't have to do that. So if that's what she wants and that's what comes out of the discussions with our high-risk breast center and genetics, then I'm very supportive of that. I like to get my patients through their PARP inhibitor before we do that, usually just because it complicates things with the, they're so savvy now with the reconstructions and doing it in a certain way that I like to get them through the PARP first. And usually patients are okay with that, but some aren't, and you can work it around the PARP, but I'm 100% okay with that.
Yeah. You just answered Nicholas's question in the chat room. So let's go on to the next case. I love this case. 77-year-old woman, somatic BRCA, so in the tumor, stage 4B high-grade serous ovarian cancer, who actually was on the PRIMA trial. And as it turns out, they found out when she recurred that she was on the placebo arm. So she got a niraparib on recurrence. And you'd be curious to see what his question is.
She was unblinded and she was getting placebo. She received carbo and liposomal doxorubicin with near complete response and then was placed on PARP inhibition. And she remains on niraparib, somatic BRCA2 mutation. She also is genomic and genetic CHEK2 mutation positive. Oh, how wow. long should we keep her on the niraparib?
So any thoughts?
Yeah. Like all these questions today have no clear answers. Like it's like Katie's opinion.
That's why we're asking you.
Oh my goodness.
If it was easy, we give it to somebody else. Exactly.
This is actually something we talk about this right now. So the studies were all treatment until progression. So we have to say that the data for BRCA, somatic or germline in NOVA, which is niraparib, Ariel, which is rucaparib, or Solo 2, which is olaparib, show no detriment to overall survival in the BRCA cohorts with use until progression. So we have to say that. And so the label would be to continue it. There are, I have concerns about that, I will just say, and many of us do. I won't name my colleagues, but they're incredibly smart medical oncologists. We talk about this, you know, keeping somebody beyond 3 years, 4 years, 5 years on a PARP inhibitor who's otherwise completely no evidence of disease. We do worry, and you see this in the long-term follow-up in the germline BRCA from Ariel, like the risk of secondary malignancies was like 14%, was quite high, 8% in solo. So you do start to kind of creep up there into secondary, you know, treatment-related myeloid neoplasm rates that make your head, your antennas go up. So I worry about that. And I just wonder if we're doing anything, but we just don't know. So I really have that conversation with patients. I'm going to be really honest. I tell them about the ambiguity. I tell them about the data. I have some patients that want to remain on, and that's the data. And I support them. And I watch their counts really closely for subtle drops in their ANC, drifts down, things that are, you're going to raise my antenna for maybe developing some bone marrow dysplasia. And I have very low threshold for having my heme team evaluate. But I have other patients that are like 3 years, their PET's negative, their CT's negative, their CA125 is negative. I've even been following ctDNA where there's no data. I'm telling you, there's no data for this. But if it was positive, went before I did their secondary surgery, and now it's been negative. It's been negative for 3 years. All that negative, we stop. And I keep an eye on them. That's no data for that. I have to tell you all, there's no data for that. But I am nervous about keeping someone on a drug indefinitely that could harm them. That's not curative. We know it's not curative. So that's where I am on that. So it's hard for me to answer his question. It would depend on how high risk she is, how quickly did she recur, how is she tolerating it. I'm really interested in some of these studies coming out where they're screening for CHIP mutations. We're starting to launch one of those here. I don't know if that's going to help us identify patients at risk, but at least we're doing something active to try and make sure we're looking at it in a more in-depth fashion. So I don't have a good answer, but I've done both. I am really thinking about it, though. It's not like, here you go, and we'll see you later.
So I'm thinking we ought to start doing an RTP poll on how long for each of our webinars with solid tumors it takes somebody in the chat room to ask about cell-free DNA. Actually, Savitri asked about it 16 minutes ago, actually, but you already addressed that. Everybody wants to know about that. All right, let's go into another case. Clear cell ovarian cancer, another gynecologic oncologist, Dr. Chase. Here's her case.
This lady is a clear cell ovarian cancer patient, BRCA negative, HR proficient, got 6 cycles of carboplatin paclitaxel at this outside institution. There was improvement, and so we did interval surgery, and then followed by interval surgery, she had more cycles of chemo. At her interval surgery, she still did have disease. And then she went on bevacizumab maintenance. And then now currently her CA125 is increasing. So she's progressing, but not with bulky disease. She has effusions. She was just admitted for thoracentesis, paracentesis. Again, no bulky disease, no bowel obstruction, no anorexia. And she's a clear cell type, and these are tricky patients. So what's the optimal sequence and approach for the clear cell types? Do the experts treat these patients any differently in terms of maintenance therapy? And then does maintenance bevacizumab and or PARP inhibitor play a role for clear cell types? And then what about any targeted therapy options that they might suggest? So typical clear cell type, what's her option?
Any thoughts?
That's a tough case. Clear cell is tough. So she's progressing on bevacizumab. She didn't tell me how long she'd been on bevacizumab and how robust the response was to chemotherapy. So that would definitely play into my first thought process. I actually just got a referral from one of my partners to phase one for a recurrent patient with recurrent clear cell. But she's been very, very chemosensitive, which is sometimes surprising in clear cell. But she's responded each time and had a year from her last platinum. So my first thought is I'm going to put her back on platinum until platinum doesn't work. So even though it's clear cell and there is this not incorrect bias that chemotherapy doesn't work as well, it sometimes does. And so if platinum has gotten a response in the past, I would use platinum again. So that's number one. I would fully molecularly characterize her. So I would send this for, we use Tempest testing here or Caris testing here. You could use Tempest or Foundation, whatever you like to use, but I would fully molecularly characterize this because you can find things in clear cell. What are we looking for? We're looking for ARID1A is one example. And we can find that in clear cells. And that does link to some clinical trial options. You're really looking for trials for patients at this point. We're looking for, you know, anything that's in the mTOR pathway. You can find those commonly in clear cells. So TSC1, TSC2, mTOR, MLL2, any of those, I'm going to be looking at either off-label, but NCCN-listed clear cell mTOR inhibitors. But there's also clinical trials like nab-sirolimus is open for TSC1, TSC2 mutated. So I'd be looking for that. And then combinations. So that's really what I'd be thinking about her. I'd be looking for all of the markers. I'd be sending it for folate. I will tell you that you do find folate expression in clear cell. You find it. But the cytotoxic on mirvetuximab is a microtubule toxin, which doesn't always work as well in clear cell, but I would try it if she was folate receptor alpha high. I would try that. So those would be the things I'd be thinking about there. And then immunotherapy, of course, for clear cell, there is data. So combination therapies with clear cell, CTLA-4, PD-1, or really trying to get to some of these next generation therapies. There's a really interesting clinical trial for platinum resistant disease. So I don't know if she's platinum resistant using an intraperitoneal, going back to our intraperitoneal discussion, vaccine that induces immunogenic cell death in concert with platinum. So they're doing it in these resistant tumors that had some response to platinum. So it's a randomized phase 3 study of platinum-based therapy. It's Ovivec is the medication. plus platinum versus platinum in platinum resistant disease, which is kind of paradigm shifting, but also really cool. And I would be thinking of a clear cell for that potential population as well, where you do see some benefit from immunotherapies. So that's what I'd be thinking about for her, but I'd be looking for trials.
So a couple of questions from the chat room. Hassan wants to know about ADCs to HER2 and HER2 positive ovarian cancer. And I want to know about, I guess at ESMO, I just started hearing about this antibody drug. Anytime I see the last name deruxtecan, it gets me interested. But this is relutimab, it's DS6000, it's going to be presented, deruxtecan, I guess that's targeting cadherin. So what about that? And also what about, you know, TDXD, is there HER2 positive ovarian cancer?
Yeah. So let me take those in two buckets. The first one, you've talked about, in full disclosure, I'm presenting that data at ESMO.
Right.
So it's relutotug deruxtecan. Relutotug deruxtecan. There you go. RDXD. Like you'll be hearing me say that.
RDXD. Like that.
I've been
better.
Practicing. Exactly. RDXD. You can use that, but relutotug deruxtecan. So this is an antibody drug conjugate that targets cadherin 6, as you said. Cadherin 6 is almost ubiquitous on high grade serous ovarian cancers, probably high grade endometrioid as well. I don't think we have as much data in clear cell. And it has clearly a deruxtecan payload. Erica Hamilton, my colleague from Sarah Cannon, presented phase one data at ASCO last year in 2022 with about a 40% response rate early on, multiple dose levels. And we're going to be presenting the expansion cohort data at ESMO in about a month. And I can't say anything because it's embargoed, but it is looking quite promising. And we are working on sort of the next steps for this drug and what the biomarker may or may not be. This biomarker or this target is kind of on everything. So, you know, maybe this will be an all comers opportunity, but we'll see. Trastuzumab deruxtecan, super excited. I was actually late to my meeting with you because I was talking about that with the company in cervical cancer. But they presented, as everybody knows, Destiny Pan-Tumor, cervix, endometrial, and ovarian cohorts. Gastric scoring, 2+, 3+. Local testing, and then they centrally confirmed it. And the response rates were amazing. Endometrial, clearly, they're, you know, that's going to be probably the priority. But cervix and ovary were kind of the dark horse winners. I don't know why we're surprised. But cervix, you know, 50% response rate overall. I know we're talking about ovary, but I'm really excited about cervix where we need things. And ovary, you know, it was 50% for 3+, about 35% for the 2+. But then in the group that was locally tested but didn't meet the central testing, it was 50%. So it doesn't matter, is my point. If you have any HER2, you can use this drug. And that's what I want to happen. Like, don't be fussy about it. It's just, we just need to use it. So ovarian cancer, about 12% are 2+, 3+ by breast scoring. That's the data we have. We do not have population data for gastric, which is a little less restrictive because it doesn't have to be circumferential staining. 1+ is 19%. So it kind of depends what the indication is, how we're going to use trastuzumab deruxtecan in ovary and what the approval pathway will look like. So it's too early to say. But stay tuned. It works. And we want it available for appropriate patients.
So one more case from the chat room. This is like the elevator case. You get on the 12th floor as you're going down. Somebody says, Uzama says, I have a 50-year-old who presents with abdominal pain, suspicious for ovarian torsion, TAHBSO noted stage PT1B. Figure 1B, bilateral ovarian cancer without involvement of the surface. Would you recommend further cancer-directed surgery for complete staging and or debulking, or just proceed with adjuvant chemotherapy?
What grade is it? Is it low grade?
I don't see it. It says figure 1B. Is that the grade? No, that's the stage.
That would be the stage.
We'll see if he puts it in there. How would that change your answer, incidentally?
If it's like, because, you know, true stage ones, I would stage her, number one, unless they're contradictions.
High grade. He says high grade.
So there it's a little more controversial. There's two thoughts here. So I'll just start. So it's low grade. It was like a grade one, grade two kind of thing. Clear cell that's not spread. Chemo is not helping that. Like, so you can give three cycles or not, but you've cured it with surgery most of the time. High grade is going to get chemo. High grade serous. So you already know she's going to get chemo. Most of us give six cycles. So your staging doesn't really change that. So prior to PARP, many people would just proceed to six cycles if they had negative imaging and PET and there wasn't any other thing. And that's probably fine. The PARP does complicate this because you do find more BRCA positive early stage. And you can find upstaging if you go look at the periodic nodes. That's the most common place you'll find upstaging, microscopic spread to the periodics, or of course the omentum, microscopic. And then if you've upstaged that patient now, which is not a good thing, but if you know that she's a stage two or three, mainly a three, if you find those two things, then that puts her on label to get access to a PARP, which in many parts of the country that's, you know, or world, you can't get it for stage one or two, like we were talking about earlier. Like that opportunity doesn't exist other outside the US, I'll just say. So you have to know that someone's advanced. So I would want to know that if it made the difference between me being able to give a potentially, could you imagine a 3A patient not getting a PARP? I mean, that's someone who's absolutely going to be cured with 2 years of PARP. So I would stage her for that reason. If you're going to just do genetic testing or somatic testing, and maybe he's already done somatic testing and you know it's not BRCA, like you could do the somatic testing if it's a BRCA wild type, then I probably would just treat. Now we have the advantage, you can send the tumor. And if it's somatic, you're going to miss 5% maybe of your germline, but you have a pretty good sense you're not dealing with a BRCA and you can just treat. So I think that's how I would think about it.
So let's go on to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Rudolph, a 61-year-old woman. And the question here is about another antibody drug conjugate, mirvetuximab.
She's a retired pharmacist. She is extremely diligent with her eye care and keeps all her ophthalmology follow-ups. She tolerated the first cycle extremely well, but after the second cycle, she complained of mild blurry vision. She also had diarrhea, and she had significant worsening of her baseline neuropathy. She was on gabapentin even before she saw me because of being exposed to paclitaxel in the past. She is scheduled to begin her third cycle of mirvetuximab after she sees her ophthalmologist. My question for her is, how common is primary refractory high-grade serous ovarian cancer? I have never seen that before. It concerns me that she blew right through treatment. Has this been studied as an entity in and of itself? And do we know of treatments that work in the space of primary refractory high-grade serous ovarian cancer? If she is not able to tolerate mirvetuximab, particularly due to her neuropathy and some blurred vision, what comes next? She has an excellent performance status otherwise. When do we test for NaPi2b? And then lastly, with all the confusion with PARP inhibitors in the recurrent space, where do PARP inhibitors fit in the sequence?
You feel like you're on rounds and 18 people are asking you questions at the same time, except it's only one person.
Like, I was ticking it down. Okay, so number one, the two of her three adverse events on mirvetuximab are very, very common and expected around cycle two. So cycle two is middle of cycle two is about where you see the ocular disturbances, and they tend to be mild, grade one to two. So patients will present with blurry vision or dry eye. And if it's really mild, and it sounds like it was with her, we just sort of keep treating. If they can't read, like they're like, ah, I can't read words, it would affect my driving, then we do hold cycle three until it resolves. And if it resolves very quickly and the ophthalmologist doesn't see anything worrisome, which they almost never do, then we tend to restart once they've resolved to normal vision, which does not take that long at the same dose. If it takes more than a week or so to resolve, or they have to increase the steroid drops to get it to resolve, then I bring them down to five. And that's all outlined in the dose modification. And there's a nice ocular paper that was published this year that I can get to you. I'm just blanking. It'll come to me in a second. The first author, I'm embarrassed. But it's really great. And you should take a look at that. Diarrhea is also really common, mainly grade 1 to 2, and totally responsive to over-the-counter things. Neuropathy we do see with mirvetuximab, and we talked about that in the presentation for Mirasol and Soraya. It's less than what we see with paclitaxel, but it is still there. It does tend to be later in onset than cycle 2. So I am a little surprised that the patient had this flare in cycle 2. And it makes me worried that maybe her baseline neuropathy probably was one that we wouldn't have put on the trial. But this is what happens when you move drugs into the community. You start using it kind of in everyone. In this patient's primary platinum refractory. And so I'd be desperate to find things as well. So I'd be worried about that. And I probably would dose modify her for the neuropathy if she's really that significant, and be referring to physical therapy for lots of things to try and keep her on study. We do physicokinetic taping here, which is probably beyond the point of this conversation, but it actually works. So those three things. I will say that mirvetuximab, when we did Forward One, remember there was another phase 3 trial before Mirasol. We did allow primary platinum refractory, meaning they could come on if they had recurred 1 to 3 months after their first platinum, not progressed on, but 1 to 3 months. And both the mirvetuximab arm and the primary chemo arm did terrible because they just, those tumors are so difficult. And so in Mirasol, we actually did not have those patients as a part of Mirasol. So I'm not saying I wouldn't try it, not judging. Please don't miss, I probably would try it here, but things don't work for a reason in this setting. These tumors, for whatever reason, are really hard to treat. And they're often excluded from clinical trials. So we have very little to no evidence of anything working because these patients have been excluded, fairly or unfairly. That's where we are. So it's a problem.
So I was all excited about UpRi, a new antibody drug conjugate with a different target, NaPi2b, and we've been talking about it over the last 6 months or so. And then all of a sudden in June, we saw this press release that it's on hold. So any thoughts about the future of UpRi?
There's not a future.
Not going to be.
No. No, they had a press release with the top line results from the UpNext study
that
really
negative.
Underperformed. Yeah, surprising. I really would like to understand better, and that's beyond the point of this talk, but that wasn't the experience we had with the drug here, but something clearly went wrong with that. So, but it's not the end of sodium. So I do think sodium gated phosphate channel, NaPi2b, is a good target. We've had that before in lifastuzumab. That I was a part of, Joyce Liu, Susanna Banerjee. That was a good drug. It just wasn't at the time, this was a long time ago. We've learned a lot since then about biomarker optimization, dose optimization, patient selection. So I think it was just wrong drug, right drug, wrong time, maybe. There are other companies bringing some novel NaPi2 targeting ADCs forward right now that are not quite in the public domain yet. So I don't think it's the last you're going to hear about it. And I don't think it had anything to do with the target. I think it was other things in play. So I do think the target is still relevant and we should continue to study it. And you'll see some agents coming forward relatively soon. I'm sorry, I'm being coy, but you have to respect confidentiality, but it's not over, but this particular agent is over.
So actually, Dr. Rudolph's in the chat room and says, this is interesting, that the patient's ophthalmologist gave her contact lenses to help her retain moisture in her eyes, and that helped her. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, no. We actually advise against contact lenses so you don't have any trauma, but that's really interesting. And I'd be interested to learn more about that. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe try it. So we're not going to present the next cases in the interest of time because I want to try to do a couple of the survey questions, and you all can check out the rest of them and some of the other things we pulled. But we did have a case of a patient who got Tumor Treating Fields and actually, as you can see, had a lot of skin toxicity. Again, I was all excited because at least it was different. But here's another press release. I guess this isn't, they had a positive phase 3 trial in non-small cell lung at ASCO, which, was pretty interesting. I'm not sure they're going to be ready to move on it at all, but, and this was pretty disappointing. Again, any thoughts?
I wanted to see the data. We were excited when we saw the lung data, and this is different. And, you know, it's like, gosh, maybe something, you know, sometimes you have to be a paradigm breaker and innovate really to move things forward. And so this is doing that. So I think that was what made it really exciting. We just want to see the data. Are there subgroups who benefited? Are there any signals in it that we can learn something from? You do learn a lot from negative trials that can help you build a better mousetrap the next time around. So I'm not, I don't know one way or the other if that one's done. More to come. And I think we'll hear some from the company as they're ready to release data to make some assessments on what the future plans are. I wouldn't say that one is, I don't think a fork is in that one, like the other one.
Yeah, I think it was interesting with the lung data. It looked like the patients were with getting IOs, you know, immunotherapy, they were benefiting chemo didn't. I'm not sure what that means,
well,
but I guess.
And that's consistent with some of their preclinical work. So that's, yeah. But lung is lung and ovary is ovary. And,
yeah,
and so sometimes things happen in lung and we're like, yay. And then we do an ovary, like imagine 50, my study. It worked in lung, does not work in ovary. So we just have to recognize the differences that seem obvious, but.
So before we get to, I'll show a couple. We'll get in the next one of these. We'll get into more of the poll. We'll show it in a second. But I've got to ask you about this paper presented at ASCO, Duo ENGOAT, looking at durvalumab, paclitaxel carbo, Bev, and olaparib. A pretty complicated thing, a trial in terms of the structure. Can you kind of simplify it for us back home who just want to figure out what it is and what it means?
Yeah. So this is Duo-O that was led by two of my great friends, Carol Agajanian and Philip Harder. It was designed a long time ago. We would design it differently today. I'm going to say that. It's for BRCA wild type, randomized to chemo plus bevacizumab maintenance versus chemo, bevacizumab, bevacizumab maintenance. That should remind you of Imagine 50 versus chemo, durvalumab, bevacizumab. Bevacizumab, durvalumab, olaparib maintenance. That was the study. The initial statistical analysis planned was to compare the progression-free survival in homologous recombination deficient tumors. Remember, these are BRCA wild type, but HRD for arm 3, the triplet, versus arm 1, which is just Bev. So 3 things versus 1. And that was positive. And then they looked at the intention to treat group 3 versus 1, and that was positive. And so based on their pre-specified statistical analysis plan, this would be considered a positive study comparing maintenance bevacizumab, durvalumab, olaparib versus bevacizumab. The problem is that we don't really know what durvalumab is adding to the mix. So this is basically PAOLA 1 again. It tells me to use olaparib in this population with Bev as opposed to Bev, but it doesn't convince me to use durvalumab because there's a missing arm because you just can't have 4 arms. So it's hard to do these studies and armchair quarterbacking is not fair. And I'm not doing that. I'm just admitting we would design it differently today. Would we be designing it today? As it is, I don't think it's going to be really interpretable as to the contribution of durvalumab.
All right. Well, maybe a future trial will define it better. Let's finish out with a few of the faculty's treatment preferences. We're going to start out with the scenario of a younger patient, 65 years old, presents with extensive disease, including ascites, gets neoadjuvant carbo-paclitaxel and Bev, has a good response, R0 resection. So we presented several scenarios to the faculty. In our way of doing consensus conference, Katie, is we ask people what they do. And if they all say the same thing, then we know there's a consensus. Looks like there's a PAOLA consensus here in the BRCA or PAL-B2 situation. What about the duration? There's a little bit of variation there, but any thoughts about that?
I think we're all seeing kind of the same thing. Dr. Monk's probably just trying to, he likes to make things simple. And so just do the same amount for both drugs. The study was 15 months and 2 years. And so that's, you know, what I do. Patients are usually really happy to stop the bevacizumab a little bit early. So, but I think we're all saying the same thing. I don't think there's any like you know, subtlety to the answers.
I like how Dr. Martin and O'Malley pushed the Bev out to a year, I guess, to make it like even or something. But yeah. Anyhow, of course, next scenario is BRCA wild type, but LOH high. Again, everybody's saying the same thing. Any comment? And what are the other mutations of both somatic and germline? I forgot to ask you about the check too, or maybe you commented on it from the prior case. Any other mutations that you kind of think about in the same way or similar way to BRCA or PALB2?
Yeah, that's a good question. The mutations that have the strongest, I guess you can say, validation as predictive biomarkers are BRCA1 and 2, either germline or somatic, and RAD51C. Those are the ones that really look like they do predict outcome. The rest of them are so low frequency, it's kind of been all over the place. If you recall from the PAOLA-1 study, they did an exploratory analysis where they looked at these gene panels and tried to see if these gene panels of homologous recombination repair genes would predict benefit from PARP more than the HRD assay. And in fact, it was all over the place. It didn't correlate with HRD at all, and it did not have any predictive capability in terms of benefit from olaparib. Now, it was exploratory. The GSK first study, which you'll see report out next year in the frontline, has that as a primary stratification factor. And so we'll get a lot more data on whether or not any of those mutations mean anything. But right now, it's really those three. The rest of them are kind of like, what should I do with this? Check two. I'm not sure. I'd use a PARP, but you don't really know that you're helping that. So
Katie, thank you so much for working with us today. I sort of miss seeing your dog when we do Zoom at home. I like to see your dog's tail wagging back and forth.
Walking behind me, yeah.
Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back next Tuesday. We'll hear what's new. I want to hear about magrolimab and why that seems to be crashing a little bit. But we'll talk about AML and MDS with Dr. Daver. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.